The whole concept of glamour is always interesting to think about, because the term itself originally means an illusion, a magical illusion. The idea is that a witch or a fairies can put a glamour on someone or on themselves, and it's to create an illusory appearance. And then it gets taken up in the early 20th century. It becomes part of the vocabulary of fashion as contemporary consumer culture is starting to emerge for the first time. And as aspirational fashion becomes something which is accessible to working class people and middle class people in ways it hadn't been historically. And the whole question of who gets to determine what is fashionable and what isn't fashionable at the level of clothing in particular really becomes an interesting and open cultural question. And there's this period in the middle decade of the 20th century when there's this sort of relationship between Hollywood and the haute couture fashion houses of Paris and the fashion magazines and the film star magazines. And that sort of nexus determines what's fashionable. And then part of what happens in the 60s is, for the first time, really, there are kind of innovations in fashion happening outside those very rarefied zones, and to some extent the kind of fairly unpredictable kind of changing tastes of young people in particular are themselves starting to take on a kind of autonomous capacity to determine fashion trend. I mean, one of the things about the Beatles that there's a lot of excitement about is that, well, they have this distinctive look, which is basically their own look, or it was really Brian Epstein's idea that that's what they should look like, and they're not following some other kind of dictates. I mean, you can say the same thing about people like Elvis, I guess, and partly indeed that does have to do with the complex relationships between sort of high fashion and then the idea of black culture as an autonomous site at which ideas of glamour are generated, which then become attractive to other social constituencies. And then, yeah, there is this rejection of the idea alongside a general rejection of consumer culture, at least within the more radical and politically self-conscious elements of the countercurrent culture in the late 60s. But then on the other hand, it depends how broadly you want to extend this idea of the counterculture, because it's certainly the case that very self-consciously spectacular glamour of certain kinds is a big part of hippie culture, if not counterculture proper, in the late 60s. I mean, it's still the case now. If you talk to people about hippie culture in Britain in particular, actually, much more than in the States, actually, in the late 60s, then it's still the case that what it means to a lot of people is, you know, people buying really expensive psychedelic paisley clothes on Carnaby Street in 68, 67, 68, 69. That's still what people associate quite strongly with the scene that bands like Pink Floyd came out of. Actually, if you think about specifically about something like Pink Floyd, like on their first album, on the cover, that, you know, in the pictures accompanying the promotion, they're all dressed in these sort of incredibly expensive sort of psychedelic frock coats and silk shirts or whatever. But then before the end of the 60s, they're just going around in t-shirts and jeans, and they're taking themselves, and that is a signifier that they're taking themselves much more seriously.
Well, there's also the Beatles and the Sgt. Pepper's. They've got these, you know, they're wearing these brightly coloured suits. It's kind of quite, or an Oriental influence, silk suits. And of course, they all had their long hair at different points as well.
The last couple of years of the 60s, it's all denim and shirts, and they're much more down. Yeah, it's much more deliberately kind of toned down.
Yeah, and the Stones had their sort of, they were quite a dandy look, wasn't there, with the Rolling Stones as well?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, it's complicated. Certainly counterculture goes through it. It's probably a few phases, it seems, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I tend also to want to resist the conflation of hippie culture with counterculture. That, like, I would say they sort of overlap with each other. And, you know, hippie culture has its moment, especially around 67, of being broadly fashionable and popular and... But at that moment, it's not countercultural. It's, you know, we've talked about this on the show loads of times. The Beatles do that big All You Need Is Love broadcast, like on the BBC. It's kind of mass culture. And then at the moment when people like Lennon are becoming more self-consciously politicized, that's exactly the moment when he's very deliberately going around looking, you know, like he's wearing much cheaper clothes, for example. So all that is happening, but then to some extent one might say it remains the case that, you know, for a large section of the audience of those bands anyway, buying nice clothes and adopting a very specific kind of look is a really important form of self-expression. It might be the only form of significant self-expression that's really available to them. Now, this is one of the moments that Colin Campbell writes about in his book, The Social Historian. Colin Campbell wrote this book, I'm sure I've talked about on the show before, which traces a lineage from the Romantic movement in the late 18th, early 19th century, right through to consumer culture in the 60s and afterwards, and talks about this, the idea of consumption, spectacular forms of consumption, including style and fashion as modes of self-expression, and that becoming a really important element of contemporary subjectivity. For better or worse, I think one of the conditions for glam, actually, as I think there's obviously some sense in which the desertion of that particular zone of culture by people like the Beatles and Lennon leaves open a space in which people, audiences, are sort of hungry for something that looks a bit spectacular, for people who look like stars, and for people who are doing things that maybe they can imitate at home in a way that makes them feel excited and exciting. Like if they don't want to, you know, just go to consciousness raising groups in their jeans and dungarees.
Well, and also you should, I mean, there's the whole background of, you know, the gay liberation and the feminist movement and the, you know, challenges to what are commonly understood to be, you know, the institutions of patriarchy as an important precursor to the emergence of glam. Also, in, I mean, just developing this point around what was going on in the late 1960s and to what extent it was a precursor of glam, early glam rock culture. I think there's a sense in which, in some respects, counterculture enabled glam. From another point of view, one could argue that glam abandons counterculture. It's not interested in revolutionary rhetoric. It celebrates, you know, decadence. It's explicitly attached to and admiring of superficiality. Much more, is more interested in sort of how you look than what you say or what you do. It seems a lot of it's revolves around pop culture. I think as we'll go on to explore, a lot of its kind of breakthrough moments sort of happen on Top of the Pops. I don't know. Honestly, I mean, maybe you do, to what extent it was like a grassroots, organic social movement more than as a series of interconnected performers who latched on to a similar style and a similar way of being that in particular played on what they were wearing and how they portrayed their sexuality at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, all that's true, but I think it is also at this specific moment, the demarcation lines between grassroots music culture and mass media culture are very blurry. I mean, this is the moment in history when you can be a local band, like touring and making demo tapes, and you can send them to a record company and to the music, and to the NME or the Melody Maker. And within a year or so, you can have a contract and be on Top of the Pops and be a big deal. So the relationships between those things are very porous at this time. A figure like John Peel, at this moment, he is both becoming a national figure on Radio One, but he is also closely associated with that legacy of the psychedelic counterculture when he came out of the pirate stations. But then he becomes best mates with Mark Bolan in the early 70s. So I think there's a lot of circulation between those zones at this time. I think there's a lot of blurriness.